Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael Vann of Sacramento State University, but please call me Mike. Today, I have three guests, Alex Wichili, George Herrera, and Philip Cunliffe. They are the hosts of Afe Bunga Bunga, which bills itself as the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. I strongly recommend the podcast, as I think it's one of the most well-informed and thoughtful political podcasts out there, even if I don't always agree with them. Indeed, while I frequently find myself disagreeing with one of their arguments or positions, I always appreciate their intellectually sound and theoretically really rigorous challenges to the things that I think. And sometimes they change my mind. Today, we'll be talking about their co-authored book, The End of the End of History, Politics in the 21st Century, published by Zero Books in 2021. Gentlemen, welcome to New Books in History.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. When there's three of us as guests, we don't know in which order to speak.
It's like the three Stooges going through the door at once.
Yeah.
And then we all bang heads and try exactly the same thing again, ad nauseum. Yeah. But no, really, really happy to be here. And yeah, looking forward to the discussion.
Okay. So rather than having the listeners listen to me read your CV and prattle on, why don't you each introduce yourselves? So as a Van, I hate the tyranny of the alphabet, even though you guys are all in the front part of the alphabet. So we'll go in reverse order. Alex, you first. You're a researcher, writer, and a translator joining us from Sao Paulo, Brazil. Please tell us where and what you studied and what you do now.
Yeah, so I mean, my academic background was in international relations. I studied international relations at undergrad at the London School of Economics, and then a postgrad at King's College London, and then further another postgrad degree at University of Kent, where I was at the same time as Phil, but certainly not studying with him. I would refuse to learn anything from Phil, even if he had things to teach me. I would refuse. So I studied. My interest was mainly in consumerism and the spirit of capitalism, things which I guess to a certain extent were parlayed into the book, at least a bit kind of in the introduction. And now, as you said, I mean, I'm a writer, translator, and researcher, and I also do consultancy work on kind of research and kind of language services, and that's what I do here in São Paulo, where I've lived for the past nearly 6 years.
And where can we find some of your writing?
You can find my writing in the Brazilian Report, in Jacobin, and now I'm going to forget everything else that I kind of have written for and write for. But you can find me at alexhochili.xyz. So.
Yeah.
Or XYZ.
And I saw you reviewed. Yeah, thank you. We appreciate that. I saw you reviewed White Lotus for Jacobin, and I'm from Hawaii, so I was happy to see a critique of that in there. I've yet to watch it. And I didn't want to read the review, but it's on my list. But
Yeah. Anyway, no, there's maybe a couple of spoilers in there, so maybe leave that one for after you watch.
Oh, I will. George, you have a doctorate in political science from Oxford. What is your area of expertise, and what do you do with yourself?
Doctorate in essentially kind of political theory stuff. I was I've written previously on the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, who's got a lot of, I think, quite influential, particularly in Anglophone cultural studies and maybe post-colonial theory as well. And what do I do with myself now? I'm no longer an academic. So that's, you know, often recovering academic, I think, is the way people put it. But no, I work in, I live and work in London, which is where I'm calling you from. It's such a cliche that Brits always talk about the weather, but it's a really nice day today. So you can see the sun shining in my window, which is very unusual. In terms of sort of what I've written recently, I've had a few pieces in Damage magazine, which I think is a really interesting publication, and also at the Full Brexit as well. A few kind of analyses of Brexit, British politics, and COVID as well.
Philip, you're the returning champion, as you were previously on New Books in History to talk about Lenin Lives, a really fun counterfactual history of the 20th century. You also have a doctorate in international relations from King's College and currently teach at University of Kent. Tell us a bit about yourself and your work.
I'm delighted to be back on your podcast. So as you mentioned, I teach at the University of Kent. I'm a senior lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations, and my work is mostly in liberal conflict management and its various inadvertent consequences and pathologies since the end of the Cold War, particularly humanitarian intervention, responsibility to protect, and United Nations peacekeeping. So that's my area of expertise, and it's when I'm not doing podcast stuff, it's mostly what I work on in terms of research.
Great. So the three of you created the Afe Bunga Bunga podcast in April 2017, I believe. What is the origin of the podcast, the origin story in comic book speak? What's your, you know, your mission statement for Afe Bunga Bunga? And also, I'm curious as to why a podcast? What did this genre offer you?
Well, I guess like many great things, it began as a WhatsApp group. I had moved to Brazil at the beginning of 2016, and anybody who knows recent Brazilian history will know that it was a very turbulent time. It saw the institutional coup that year. And so the three of us were talking. We'd been friends for a long time. We'd known each other for maybe a decade by that point. So we were just kind of chatting. I think it started off as a terribly named Political Musings WhatsApp group. But as things went on, and of course that was the year that Brexit happened, suddenly it was like, wait, politics is back in some form. At least things are getting much more disruptive than they used to be. And, you know, we were people who grew up, we're kind of all older millennials, and Phil will dispute that and shout that he's a young Gen Xer. But, anyway, the point being is that growing up in the late 90s and early 2000s, we were struck by obviously the fact that there was no politics, that everything was kind of wrapped up in kind of consensus, and there would seem to be no movement whatsoever. And so we were like, wow, okay, things are happening. And so early in 2017, one of us, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't me, but either George or Phil suggested that, how about we do a podcast? Because obviously there were lots of kind of new left-wing podcasts springing up. And from the very start, we wanted it to be about sort of the end of history. I think we probably already had that sort of strapline right from the start. But the content of it and the kind of general tone was something that evolved over the kind of first year or so, trying to figure out exactly what we wanted to do with it. But it was pretty clear that we were about kind of exploring the contours of the emerging world, or maybe the world that we knew, which was falling away behind us.
Did you guys have any broadcasting experience prior to that?
I had done some radio in university, and I had done kind of some program, managing the radio station, stuff like that. But nothing kind of more serious than that. No.
Yeah.
I would say we were more like a punk band. We were like, yeah, we can learn as we go. We can learn on stage our instruments. I think that was more our vibe.
That sounds like it's being self-aggrandizing, but really it just, George, means that we can't play our instruments. So, that's it.
Well, I really like that, because I organized a panel for the next American Historical Association, if it meets in person, with the really cheesy cliche title is podcasting the new punk rock for academic historians who gone into podcasting. And there's a number of us who do, and we don't do anywhere near as well as these professional broadcasters who talk about history. I don't need my students to recommend the Dan Carlin Hardcore History podcast to me. I will never listen. And to his credit, he corrects people and says he's not a historian. But anyway, we'll leave that one there. So how's the book an extension of the podcast?
Yeah, I mean, so Alex's origin story there, I think, was quite highfalutin in some senses. I mean, the way I remember it is that we went to the pub and we thought we could do a podcast. Let's do it. But no, I think one thing that really came out of, you know, over the years that we've done the podcast is that we wanted to continue the conversations that we'd had with guests, the particularly high quality of feedback from listeners and like the prompts to make us take it more seriously and to, I think, really put some thought and preparation into some of the topics and to try some new things out. I think that kind of led into the idea that we could, you know, we could try and systematize some of these things. We didn't sort of see many books out there that were really responding to the kind of the situation as it was developing post 2016 in the way that we would have wanted. So yeah, I think that's what the book essentially tries to put some of the frameworks that we'd been testing out in conversation and developed with guests. I think it's really important to say some really, you know, some really top draw guests who made us think and gave us some great ideas that we borrowed and cited. We didn't obviously steal in creating the book. But yeah, I think that was our aspiration, was to try and, you know, provide some frameworks that could help listeners or readers in this case think about global politics, particularly post 2016.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of the key terms and concepts that you utilize in the podcast, but in the book, and really explain in the book. Let's start with the most obvious. What is the end of history? I mean, obviously, this comes from Francis Fukuyama's well-known and really much derided essay and then book. But you offer what I think is a really persuasive defense of the end of history. Concept. I'll you know, come out and say that I'm one of those historians that just enjoyed dunking on Francis Fukuyama for years, and actually have a lecture at the end of my 20th century world history class where I talk about competing narratives in the 90s with Francis Fukuyama versus you know, the clash of civilizations versus what I think is the most persuasive is Chalmers Johnson's blowback concept. But reading this chapter on the end of history, it really challenged me to reconsider Francis Fukuyama. And anyway, so give me the sales pitch on the end of history, and tell me why I shouldn't be writing off Francis Fukuyama.
I'm delighted to hear the chapter, that you found the chapter interesting and persuasive. I suppose, I mean, maybe one reason to write it off is the fact he's kind of written it off himself. But despite that, we do want to defend his original proposition. So, I mean, you know, in the last, I don't know, 20 years or so, he's hedged and kind of qualified. But I still think, and I think we all do, that the original proposition is still solid enough that it needs to be thought about and engaged with in a serious way. And so the idea of the end of history was what Francis Fukuyama, how he coined the post, or how he described the post-Cold War period. So that with the end of the geopolitical standoff between the Soviet Union and the United States and the social systems that they represented of Soviet communism and liberal democracy, liberal capitalism, meant that there was, after that conflict ended, there was no fundamental dispute over the basic principles and structures of social and political life. And that as a result of that, that changed the quality of all of politics and all of society. So, I mean, frequently one of the ways in which the end of history was misinterpreted was that it was understood as claiming, you know, that there'll be nothing new ever again, you know, as if time stops or as if there'll be no new events. But that isn't what the claim was. The claim was that history, in the sense of the search for new political structures and new forms of human government, that contestation was over because it had been resolved in the favor of liberal democracy. And this was inspired by Fukuyama's idea, was inspired by Hegel's philosophy of history, the German philosopher Hegel, who made a similar analogous claim at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, that with the defeat of Napoleon and the universalization of the constitutional principles that undergirded the French Revolution, similarly that the peak of human development, political development, had been reached, or at least that's one way in which the claim is understood. So Fukuyama kind of rehashed the idea at the end of the Cold War, and we found it persuasive because it seemed to speak to the fact of overarching political consensus as the character of the post-Cold War period, which Alex already mentioned as the kind of the times through which we grew up, and that we kind of entered into political maturity, or at least adult maturity, if not political maturity, that it seemed a good way to characterize the kind of the centrist blandness, the lack of ideological dispute, and this the fundamental stability of the existing institutions of Western capitalism at the time.
Yeah, and what I found really interesting in that in your discussion was noting that with Hegel, at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, that there's a number of ends of history throughout history, and there will be future these ends of history moments where this consensus is established after these prolonged conflicts.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. So your book and the subtitle of the podcast is The End of the End of History. So what does this mean, to the end of the end of history?
Yes, so the claim is that period, that more or less 20, 30-year cycle, depending on how you want to date it, but from, say, the end of the Cold War through to the great financial crash of 2008, or perhaps to 2016 with with Britain's vote to leave the European Union and the election of Donald Trump as president of the US. So that post-Cold War period comes to an end, so that you have once again political contestation over fundamental constitutional questions, and the offering up of meaningful political choices. So when you had the breakthrough of certain populist parties in the European Union, and as well as obviously Bernie Sanders' breakthrough in 2016 when he challenged Hillary Clinton for becoming the presidential candidate for the Democratic Party, it was very clear that there were meaningful, or at least genuine and genuinely different political choices in a way that you wouldn't have been able to say 10 or 5 years previously. And so we characterize this as the end of history, which is to say that post-Cold War period that Francis Fukuyama described had come to an end, but at the same time, it wasn't clear that it was being replaced by anything substantive. So it was being chiseled away and in some cases demolished with various populist wrecking balls, the end of history period, but there was nothing that was being erected in its place. And as we've seen, I think, over the last few years, all of the challenges to liberal centrism have been more or less beaten off. They've beaten back and defeated in various ways, and they failed to really institutionalize their gains or to leave any lasting imprint, I think, on the political order. And so I think this vindicates what we've been talking about. So it's the end of something, but it doesn't feel like it's really the beginning of something new.
To jump in there, I think to reinforce that point, I think the end of the end of history, that double negative, we hope that that captures something of the cultural moment, that there is a sense of a certain kind of period of politics ending. But there's not really a dominant project. And I'm sure we'll come on to talk about this, but there's not really a dominant project to take its kind of place. So you're left with this sense of cultural exhaustion and a whole range of morbid symptoms, as the cliche goes, that erupt in this period, because there's the end of one thing without really the start of the next thing.
Gee, that sounds almost Gramscian.
Yes, that was the illusion. Yeah, sadly, it's actually true that, all these morbid symptoms arise in the interregnum, but it has now become a cliche, so I should not use it, but it's true.
I don't want to hear that because I just sent off a draft with that in print. So,
okay. But it's true.
And you know what I find, as a historian and not a political scientist, really useful about your discussion is that in contrast to when Fukuyama's writing at the start of this time period, which, you know, seemed a little precocious, right? To declare, here's the new era. Where you are looking back after several decades and doing a postmortem on this time period and playing the role of historian, looking at this end of history moment and saying, here are the key characteristics. And one of the things I loved about that chapter is that you lay out the political, but also link it to the economic patterns, cultural manifestations, and so forth. Could you say a few words on maybe sort of the culture of the end of history that you've observed? That you note in that chapter?
Yeah, I mean, I think the term which would wrap it all up would be a certain form of presentism, or to maybe cite another cliche, the quote that I think is Frederick Jameson's originally, that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, is something that remains true throughout the period and unfortunately is probably still with us. So it kind of, despite the fact that everything was fairly, especially like within the broader Western bubble, things were pretty staid and calm and not really disruptive, bar some terrorist attacks. Cultural manifestations were completely dominated by kind of catastrophic imaginings, right? You know, like the idea that 9/11 was imagined before it ever happened. It was there in Hollywood. While at the same time, kind of what was supposedly outside of mainstream culture lost any kind of sense of connection to any alternative proposal or vision of the world or genuine counterculture. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, you could say that the counterculture became completely absorbed by the mainstream, or, and to put it maybe in a more provocative way, you know, the mainstream fell apart. You know, like we're all outsiders today. That kind of sense of a moral majority or a silent majority that used to dominate, you know, especially American politics, but I think politics across the West from the 1950s onwards seems to have kind of collapsed in on itself. So in that regard, it was only things like, you know, what's happening that's alternative and challenging. You know, you think of, I think we cite this in the book, you know, like Rage Against the Machine, but it almost seemed like a kind of desperate attempt to politicize things when there wasn't actually any politics going on.
Yeah. I mean, I think my sort of end of history moment was when, and this relates to that sense of counterculture, alternative culture being absorbed in the mainstream, is when Carnival Cruises ran an ad for cruises in the Caribbean using Iggy Pop's Lust for Life.
Yeah.
And yeah. My brain pretty much exploded at that point. I'm happy Iggy's getting paid, but this is not okay. Something is wrong with the world.
We cited another example of that, but in reverse was like Adbusters magazine, which was always a kind of a pretty superficial rebellion, in my view, you know, kind of challenging advertising, which then started selling its own unbranded sneakers. And, you know, that was, I think, the death knell of the counterculture.
You know who turned me on to Adbusters back then was a friend of mine who worked in advertising.
Perfect.
He's a photographer. It's, failed artist photographer who had a career in advertising. And he turned me on to that. So let's get into some of the other concepts, such as post-politics and anti-politics. Alex, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah. So the thing about, I guess what the task was, is that if we're saying politics is back, or at least the ways in which politics had been kind of clamped down upon and being and wrapped up in this kind of, warm coating of consensus over the 90s and 2000s, then how is politics back? You know, really putting politics itself into question, not talking about left versus right or socialism versus capitalism or these other forms of polarization, but asking whether, you know, what is politics and what are the ways that it can be furthered? What way can things be politicized? And what are the ways that things are kind of kept a lid on, to put it that way, right? And this is something that's of interest to the left, to any kind of progressive and radical movements, because the whole idea of politicization is that you want to challenge the way that things currently are. And so politics is intimately tied to what the left is or should be, right? That it's that the left is politics or the left is what kind of instantiates politics by creating a challenge to the way things are. And it's always conservatives who want to say, no, let's not talk about these things. Let's just, you know, put them back in their box, right? So like to get into the kind of more political science-y sort of language of it, post-politics is that form of management, of managing a present and managing the kind of raised earth where socialist movements, alternative politics, and working class organizations once were. So as they were defeated globally by the sort of neoliberal onslaught at the end of the 1980s, and probably most visibly with Reagan and Thatcher in the US and the UK, though the story is the same kind of elsewhere, that, you know, in this place of that, instead of having the kind of the ruling class attacking the working class, you had a form of management saying, let's not basically talk about politics. Everything was a matter of consensus. Key political questions, I mean, the typical one being, you know, setting interest rates, for example, monetary policy, that was made an independent matter. It was not to be touched by elected governments. It was put in the hands of technocrats. Quangos became in charge of generating regulation. And so ever greater areas of what was politics and was subject to political contestation became put outside the realms of democracy. And that's basically post-politics. It's a strategy of depoliticization led from the top. And so at the same time as you have this kind of withdrawal of the people from politics, the people become less and less interested, become more apathetic and so on. What really drives this is it comes from the top, that thing that politics doesn't matter anymore. So you're going to vote, but you're going to get and end up with the same thing anyway. And that's basically post-politics. It's not just an acceptance that, hey, there's going to be political conflict, but we want to keep it moderate. It's like, no, there is no conflict. There is no real contradiction. We just need to manage it and follow the best advice that the experts give us.
And as a historian, I have to ask, so when does post-politics sort of become dominant in this end of history period?
I mean, in the 1990s, really, I would say. And I grew up in Britain then. And so for me, it was like the Tony Blair government of New Labour was the real avatar of that post-political form of management, because it was ruling over the ashes. You know, this was, you know, as Thatcher famously said, that her greatest success was Tony Blair, was New Labour, which they kind of completely bought into the grounds of Thatcherism. That's basically it right then. Basically, you know, not even recognizing that there was an enemy anymore to be fought, or that there were divisions within society, right? We're all middle class today, as he said.
Yeah, and then on this side of the Atlantic, Clinton's consensus building.
Yeah, and he was there even earlier, yeah.
Right. I think Michael Moore described Bill Clinton as his favorite Republican president.
There you go. Anti-politics. So anti-politics then, and that's a far more ambiguous thing. I think post-politics is fairly well established as a term. Anti-politics is far more ambiguous, and a part of the thing that we wanted to do with this book is kind of put our stamp in it and try to nail down what it actually is, because people sometimes talk about anti-politics as being what I've just described post-politics as, i.e. depoliticization, when actually what we have identified as kind of anti-political movements are generally movements from below, or that seem to come from below, which set themselves against the political class, the political establishment, the political system. But in being a rejection, it has a purely negative quality to it. So it says that, you know, they don't represent us. They don't have a right to rule, all of them up there. And it extends beyond politicians, but also goes to, you know, maybe civil servants, the judiciary, the media, the legal system, and various appendages to what I guess would be the establishment. But it doesn't really militate in the name of an idea. It's not like socialist movements in the past would say, you know, or revolutionary movements especially say, you know, they don't represent us, they're not fit to rule, but we're going to take charge and implement and try to create this new social order. You know, it's just purely a rejection. So what makes it really ambiguous and really curious is that it seems to be politicizing. And, you know, one of the terms, or one of the, I guess, manifestations of anti-politics would be what is often called populism, which seems to be politicizing because it says, hey, we don't all have the same interests. This idea of consensus is completely false. What the experts say is actually completely self-interested. And we're going to challenge that. You know, you up there, the political class, don't have the same interests as us, the majority, the people, whatever. And so that's politicizing. That's important. That's the kind of first step to politicizing and creating, you know, division. But at the same time, and what we warn against in the book and say that anti-politics is this dangerous thing, is that it kind of takes away any possibility, any grounding for democratic legitimacy. Because if it says, you know, they're not fit to rule, but kind of no one else is, that representation maybe is even impossible, then who is going to rule? It creates this vacuum. And I mean, we talk a lot about Brazil in the book because I think it's, I mean, we all agree, I think, that it presents a very perfect crystallization of a lot of these tendencies, you know, and if you look at Brazil's history from 2013 to today, it's pretty obvious how that works, you know, big anti-corruption protests which say, you know, the whole political class is corrupt. Okay, fair enough. There's loads of corruption. What are you going to do to change that? It says, no, just get rid of them all. They're all corrupt, right? That kind of takes away any sort of legitimacy for the political class and creates room for either for authoritarian kind of interlopers who base their appeal on kind of charismatic authority or direct rule, dictatorship, and so on. Or even worse, you get kind of new technocrats coming back in different guises. And here maybe I'll foreshadow something we might talk about in a little bit. But, you know, someone who comes in who's, for example, a businessman who says, hey, I'm not from politics. I'm not part of that, like, in club of whatever. I'm a guy who gets things done. I'm a dynamic, modernizing guy. I'm going to come in and not be corrupt because I'm not going to be corrupt because I'm rich. Why am I going to steal? And try to present this kind of new face to politics. But that ends up just recapitulating the same form of, you know, elite technocracy that people rebelled against in the first place. And so there's this kind of dangerous recursiveness to anti-politics.
Right. And in the Brazilian case, if I remember correctly, when Dilma Rousseff was ousted in that sort of legislative coup, wasn't there a high percentage of Brazilian parliamentarians who had corruption charges pending that voted to remove her for corruption?
Yeah, a third to a half of Congress had charges against them, you know, already been found guilty. So,
which just makes that whole anti-corruption stance totally absurd. And then to go further north in the United States with Trumpism and the drain the swamp mantra, I mean, what does that even mean, right? I mean, it's this rallying against some sort of grievance, but no, is it that anti-politics has nothing to put in its place?
That's basically it. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just anti, right? And I think one thing to note, I guess, is that a lot of the people who talk about anti-politics tend to be pretty small C conservative, by which I mean, you know, liberal, but basically identify politics as the form of politics that existed after the Second World War in Western Europe and North America. And, you know, it means following, you know, parliamentary rules and the whole process of politics like that. And we don't want to say that that's the be all and end all of politics. And most people who say, hey, anti-politics is this dangerous thing, don't do that, tend to be just saying we should, you know, kind of go back to the old forms of parliamentary democracy and those and following those rules. And it ends up being, you know, its own way, a kind of depoliticizing argument, right? And so we're not making a kind of a, like, let's go back to the status quo ante sort of argument here.
Mm-hmm. So walk us through the chapter on what you term the neoliberal order breakdown syndrome or NOBS or NOBS. What is NOBS and what is its various manifestations? And also I'm interested in what is the demographic base that suffers most from NOBS, suffers most from this disorder. George, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, so I think perhaps listeners can cast their minds back to the ancient times of 2015, 2016. This is so. I think a lot of what Alex was saying about the culture of that post-political period is really important here, because essentially what happened in the Anglo-American context in 2016 is you had these two completely unexpected, almost on the part of the Comintariat, inexplicable events, so Brexit and Trump. And I think this idea of NOBS, neoliberal order breakdown syndrome, is our attempt to diagnose essentially what happened to the liberal Comintariat. So you might think of your favorite broadsheet newspaper in the UK or one of the big American newspapers, Washington Post, New York Times, Guardian, Times, Financial Times, all of these examples.
We're Americans. We don't read. We watch TV. So Rachel Maddow, maybe?
Rachel Maddow, exactly. So it was our attempt to sort of try to, work out what exactly it was that characterized the response on the part of people who were supposedly experts in politics to these events in 2016 in particular, but actually has quite a long tail in various ways. So essentially what we the way we set this out was that Nobbs is the inability to accept, to explain, or to respond to political change. So some examples of characteristic symptoms in each of these cases, because we did want to kind of present this as a syndrome, is so if you can remember this kind of 2016 context, the incredulity at or denial of political change and the refusal to accept responsibility for creating contemporary conditions. So how did people respond when Trump was elected, for example? And particularly, you might argue there's whatever the conditions that created Trumpism, you know, look perhaps no further than the Obama administration and some of his supporters, some of his functionaries of various sorts. And I think it was the almost some of the rhetoric which was poured out at that time was quite shocking. And we thought, okay, there's something at work here. There must be a political explanation. And I'll kind of get to that in a second. But in terms of the inability to explain political change, well, what were the explanations adduced for Trump or for Brexit? Well, you have things like social media just cons everybody. You know, people are basically too stupid to understand what is true and what is false. You have Russia conspiracy theories, these things which came seemingly out of nowhere to occupy quite a central position in kind of the national conversation. And finally, this kind of inability to respond to political change. And again, this is on the part of what you might call the liberal establishment, or you could see journalists, academics, sorry to any academics out there, but certainly several of them were guilty of this. But a real kind of nostalgia for the recent past in, looking back to the halcyon days of 2010, when all political questions were settled, it's a kind of elite persecution complex, seeing voters as somehow being unfair to hold their representatives to account. And I think just to kind of touch back on what Alex was saying about the culture of the post-political era, that's a really big part of the explanation, because I think this idea of there is no alternative or TINA. So this was very dominant amongst all of the people, you might say, to generalize here, but everybody analyzing politics, all the commentators. And so when something which did happen, which didn't fit into that model of there is no alternative, the responses were very revealing. And I think it's also worth saying on Twitter, you saw the short circuit essentially between people's knee-jerk reactions, and they would then tweet things out. And I'm sure your listeners have some favorite examples of some of these kind of classic responses to Trumpism or to Brexit. But this is essentially what we wanted to name. It's like, what is this? Like, what happened at that point, and how did the political class and politics knowers, as the phrase goes, how did they respond to this kind of, in hindsight, quite explicable set of political or parapolitical events?
Right, and just one more time to break do the three way breakdown on the neoliberal order breakdown syndrome. It's inability
to accept. So kind of like this isn't happening, right. Inability to explain. So these kind of quite these models which basically give voters no agency, an inability to respond. So no political responses. You saw a lot of people sort of go on listening tours of rural America or outside of London, and these journalists sort of come back and be like, I can't believe people are talking about these things. They're not bought into the political process. It was quite I think we also wanted to capture that this was a very turbulent time. And there was, to name this, like, how do people respond to this set assumptions kind of starting to break down?
Yeah, and you see it manifest in these the talking heads, the commentary, and in the press and on the cable news networks, and then in more popular cultural forums. And there was the HBO film about Brexit with What's his name? The guy who's in everything.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes.
Benedict
Cumberbatch. It's Dominic Cummings.
Yeah, pointing the finger at Cambridge Analytica and so forth.
Yeah. But the crazy thing is that, it's kind of come back now, right? Because I think to a certain extent, COVID put a little bit of a dampener on that sort of, that sort of whole set of symptoms, because, for a while, like kind of the experts were back in charge. And so that stuff was, all the kind of populist insurgencies that provoked that hysterical reaction were no longer there. But I think you can kind of see it coming back with the response to Afghanistan now. There's been a kind of resurgence of knobs, right? So you've got all these people attacking Biden. I mean, basically, if some of the ideologies of the end of history were like technocracy, as we've already discussed, and humanitarianism as well, and especially humanitarian interventionism, then you can see a bunch of people complaining that, so I saw journalists attacking Biden for saying that, he was elected on a promise of competence and compassion, but now he isn't demonstrating either of these things. And there's a whole series. I mean, one kind of a leading British journalist, Janice Turner, tweeted the other day, would President Hillary Clinton have left the women of Afghanistan to illiteracy, sexual enslavement and murder? which is just crazy. I mean, it's living in a kind of nostalgic fantasy land, because of course Hillary Clinton did exactly that in Libya. So, it's replete with these examples of people kind of tearing their hair out at the fact that something that they took for granted and believed would continue and wished that would continue, effectively the forever wars and America's sense of its own authority in imposing liberal democracy around the world to no success, of course. That would continue forever, and that the fact that, even one of their own should kind of pull out the rug from underneath them is like, no, this can't be happening. Kind of in some way, Knobs neoliberal order breakdown syndrome continues.
So, Philip, do you want to link or expand upon this connection between neoliberal order breakdown syndrome and this current crisis in Afghanistan?
Yeah, just to reiterate that, how strongly visible it is among all the commentators on Afghanistan is the whole process kind of repeating itself, the inability to account for change and the nostalgia for a very recent past. And so here we have kind of knobs playing out in a few urban enclaves in this kind of war-torn, deeply violent and deeply poor country. And the presumption was that until a few days ago, everything was fine. Women's rights were improving. Everything was going in the right direction. There was a few kind of problems in the rural kind of margins, but it was all heading in the right direction. And then suddenly everything is overturned and everyone is aghast, dismayed, incredulous, unable to explain this turn of events except to call for more of the same, more humanitarian bombing, more funding for women's rights and NGOs, and so on. So I think it's an excellent recapitulation of the whole knobs that we had for a few years, 2016 to 2018 or so. It's, kind of being replicated in miniature around the fall of Kabul.
And now, in the book, there's a chapter on Berlusconi and on Italy, and obviously the podcast title is a reference to Berlusconi and his infamous bunga bunga parties. So how did Italy pave the way for this political moment? Do you want to unpack this for us, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's fascinating about Italy is that it's plunged into the end of history in a pretty abrupt manner. So you have the fall of the First Republic and the beginning of the second one at the beginning of the 90s, at the same time as Italy is trying to make itself compatible to fulfill the criteria of the Maastricht Treaty, which is kind of a lot of neoliberal restructuring. And
Italy had a significant, Communist Party,
exactly.
Doing very well in elections, right?
And so what, if the backdrop to or the kind of foundation for the end of history is the defeat of the working class, the defeat of and the sort of end of communism as a kind of real possibility, then you know, Italy lives that in a very marked way, because the Communist Party kind of undoes itself and, you know, kind of folds itself into kind of a sort of new sort of left-wing vehicle and gradually and begins its gradual road to becoming a neoliberal centrist party on the model of the US Democrats. At the same time, you have this mass anti-corruption investigation, which completely delegitimizes the whole political class. Again, here's a kind of echo of anti-politics in a way of what I was talking about earlier. And that delegitimation of the political class means that you have all the kind of parties that held up the political structure of post-war Italy, especially the Christian Democrats, whose basic job in politics was just to remain in place and govern to keep the communists out. Suddenly they had lost their raison d'etre as well. And in that vacuum, enters this guy who was previously a real estate mogul, then became a mass media mogul. I mean, he became basically television, and he brought kind of more American-style consumerist television to the Italian masses. And then decides, well, hey, maybe I'll enter politics, and he enters Parliament with a whole bunch of MPs who are employees in his advertising firm. And his whole party is not a democratic, organic political party where there's actual members and people vote on what their direction of the party might be. It's like a business party, as it's called. You know, it's completely detached from the people, effectively, from the body of the citizenry. And what he sells is an image, and this is something that I mentioned earlier when I said I was going to foreshadow something, I guess, was that this is a guy who says, hey, I'm a successful businessman, so I can be successful in politics. You don't need to listen to these old, frumpy old types, whether they're on the left with their talk of solidarity and whatever, or whether they're old kind of Christian Democrats who talk about tradition or, you know, charity or whatever kind of Catholic stuff they talk about. You know, I'm going to present a shiny new image of politics where you can go out and get what you want. Don't worry about the, you know, people telling you need to show solidarity or civic duty or charity or whatever, respect for tradition. You can just go out and go after what you want, right? So it's a very consumerist vision of politics. It's a very personalized vision of politics where it's based on him as a person selling his image. And it's a very personal, and it's one which is kind of less and less kind of democratic and organic as a vision. And it's funny because he ends up capturing so many tendencies of the end of history that we'd see played out across Europe and North America and beyond that even over the following decade. So one obviously is a kind of media mogul being involved in politics. Either, you know, you have it indirectly with Richard Murdoch, for example, Rupert Murdoch, but you have it also more directly with, for example, like Thaksin Shinawatra in Thailand, or, you know, you can think of other cases of media moguls being directly involved, or for that matter, a TV personality in the form of Trump. But also you have a guy who's basically surfing a wave of anti-corruption, of rejection of the old political class, while at the same time being totally corrupt himself. You know, he's kind of has all sorts of charges thrown at him. He's guilty of kind of engaging kind of clientelistic relations. And he has a relationship to the public, which is completely mediated by television. So, you know, if you think about kind of completely internet-driven politicians today, this was the TV politics of the 90s was just a precursor to that. And so both at the level of substance or its lack thereof, as well as its means of communication, as well as the kind of type of person that Berlusconi was, he just embodies so much of the politics and or the lack of politics of the end of history that he becomes a sort of template inadvertently or deliberately. And I mean, Trump is only the most obvious example, but you can just think of some of the things that Berlusconi would throw out as claims, which were just so Trumpian well before Trump ever did that. So, you know, he, one example we put in the book is that he goes to the island of Lampedusa in the very, very south of Italy, which is near to kind of Tunisia and Libya, actually, which was having a kind of migration crisis, right? It was receiving loads and loads of refugees. And of course, there's a panic about immigration. And he goes, no, it's fine. I'm going to have resolved this. I've even bought a house here. Right, as if his own personal behavior as this very rich man who's able to buy a house here was enough confirmation that that things were fine. It would be like Trump saying, "Hey, no, you know, Florida's fine. I've got a place in Mar-a-Lago." You know, as if that were the kind of a political argument. So it's this folding together and collapsing of public and private, and kind of the mediatization of everything, which Berlusconi does, and he does it very early, and does it really to great success. One final element just about it, which I think is important to note, is that the left was unable to land a glove on him. The left became moralistic and would try to argue against him, not in terms of necessarily defending workers' rights or standard of living. It was really about kind of civic responsibility and behaving in the correct, proper way. And here you can see echoes of kind of the left in the United States attacking Trump for not being presidential. And for a lot of people, that didn't matter to them. They didn't really care about that stuff. They didn't really speak to them. And so they became increasingly frustrated, called Berlusconi a fascist, which just is incorrect. And as I said, didn't lay a glove on him. Again, the whole template, the whole story of the 90s, 2000s, and even 2010s is told through the story of Berlusconi, even just in his early years in the early 90s.
Yeah, and I found that really gratifying because during the first year of Trump, I was telling my friends, we've seen this before. We saw this with Berlusconi. And so many of my colleagues were saying, this is unprecedented crisis. I'm like, I don't know this. I don't know that much about Italy, but just this looks real similar. George.
Yeah, I think to bring it obviously back to the title of the podcast, I think one thing reflecting on Berlusconi specifically is that these bunga bunga parties that he had ended up having a political importance because he was showing people here's how to have a fun, sexy life. And, he gave Italian voters at that point special dispensation to break the rules. And as Alex said, the moralistic left was completely unable to respond to this. I think it would, one way to put it would be his private life. He made that some aspects of it public, and that was very, very successful. And responding to that made the left seem that they didn't understand that this is, that this kind of mode of politics was going to become dominant, as it ended up doing.
Yeah, and again, so much resonates with Trump, and just the response of orange man bad and pink hats as the response, not a policy response, something that can really attend to political needs, but this moralizing.
Well, I mean, the funny thing, actually, you mentioned the kind of pink pussy hats, where Berlusconi, of course, was obviously strongly criticized by feminists for being, macho, sexist, crude, etc., which he absolutely was. But his largest constituency in society was housewives, actually. So that again kind of proves that somehow the left weren't able to get kind of leverage there, weren't able to get their hooks in. It didn't quite land.
Yeah. Well, this is all very depressing. what do you hold for our future? What do you predict for our ideological future?
Well, I don't think this is necessarily the point for too much optimism. But and so obviously in the chapter of the book, we go into a lot more detail on this. But just the broad outlines, I think the way that we would see it is essentially the right has, or the center right has, it's quite likely that we're going to see what we call state capitalism. So high state expenditure, perhaps a particular focus on addressing regional inequalities. And I think it's probably worth saying that this, I think COVID has accelerated this trend. So you see very high levels of expenditure and investment from the state from center-right perspective. And these were the people who, a lot of the same people who'd previously been talking about austerity, who'd previously been talking about the effects of the global financial crisis and the need for belt tightening. And all of that kind of ideological justification, I think, is more or less out the window. One kind of complicating factor, and I think that this is, particularly true in many states in Western Europe and in the US as well, is that this state capitalism has to contend with a state apparatus that has been hollowed out over the past 30 years. So maybe we could call it failed state capitalism. So this idea that you can turn to the state to solve problems, but you don't really have the expertise, the apparatus, the state capacity that you would have had previously. So it's a very contradictory project, but you can see this in Biden to a certain extent, in Johnson to a certain extent, in many, many examples. But this is how we would characterize, I think, perhaps the center right. And so if that's the right, what's the left? Well, I think the primary condition of the the left is the defeat of the organized working class. And what this sets as conditions for of possibility for a kind of center left or a left response. I think we call it moral minoritarianism or progressive technocracy. So the idea is that all of these energies, perhaps of left populist movements, so Bernie, Corbyn, Syriza, you know, Mélenchon in France, all of these, there's loads of them. Where do they go? Well, they were unsuccessful in producing a kind of a majoritarian project. So maybe the avenue for those energies is to kind of short circuit to a certain extent that political process and instead make arguments for how you can lock in place through non-majoritarian means. So citizens' assemblies, consultations of various sorts, how you can lock in some kind of morally important projects. And this can range from you know, a whole kind of variety of kind of anti-fascist projects, maybe some green projects, maybe some of these things. And this, you know, we see this as essentially the direction of travel. How the conflict between these two positions gets resolved is I think up for debate. But I think those are the main kind of direction of travel that. And of course, kind of generalizing across the whole world is not super easy to do, but I think that's what we're going to see. And in some ways, then the left will become the defenders of the status quo because they will be the ones who will find it easier to talk about how to kind of move in a progressive direction, while the right is saying, well, we need these big state-led responses, but center-right has no real kind of capacity to do it. So it's quite a contradictory picture, but I think there's those two camps starting to coalesce, perhaps.
Yeah, I found that section in the book where you talk about the left becoming the defender of the status quo really quite provocative and thoughtful.
I think it also is designed a little bit to provoke. I think there is a need to really assess the political, and this is partly, you know, since 2016, I think this is one of the ideas we're trying to communicate in the book is that things have change some of these fixed assumptions that may have been in place over the post-political period, over the end of history period. You know, we have to think really critically about them. Do they still really hold? Do they still define what politics is? So yeah, hopefully provoke and cause thoughts and annoy in a good way.
Yeah, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I think I guess one thing that we hint at in the book, but I think has become even more evident over the past whatever 6 months or however long it's been since we finished writing it, which is that the kind of the massive gulf in trust, I guess, and trust in the political establishment has only grown. And I think to a certain extent that was clamped down on or you know, a lid was kept on that during the height of the pandemic. And now that's now kind of spiraling out with kind of opposition to lockdown and various other measures, but also kind of more I guess, conspiratorial readings of what's happened. And as a consequence, I don't think the state capitalism, which I think George described very well of what's kind of emerging as the new political center ground, will be able to achieve any sort of stability or genuine legitimacy. And in fact, you know, I mean, it'll try to do it maybe through like direct cash transfers to circumvent the fact that there aren't kind of enough of a state apparatus to really manage things directly. You know, you don't have civil servants used to running state-owned companies, mm-hmm. for example, or massive projects like the New Deal. And so they go like, well, let's just throw people money. And you can see a little bit of that already in the US. But, you know, I don't know how stable that will be, how much that will be able to buy people's trust, because again, it's kind of so atomized as a form of welfare that it increases that feeling, those feelings of fear, of sense of repression and so on that lead to a lot of these kind of more kind of conspiratorial readings of politics.
Well, you three have been really generous with your time, but I need to wrap up. But I've got just two more questions before we let you go. First, what are you working on now? Philip, you go first.
It's actually on the themes that we've just been talking about. So it's beginning some research on the idea of the failed state, which has been the justification for so many of the wars that the West has waged over the last 20, 30 years. The idea, you know, that you have these kind of small failing states in the third world that become bastions of terrorism, and need to be intervened in order to contain the security threat that they pose. And then in the wake of the pandemic and all the upheaval that we've seen, particularly with the protests around the world and in the US in the last over the last summer, as well as the failing public health systems that buckled under the strain of COVID, it was became an unavoidable conclusion, and people started talking about state failure in the developed world, in Western states, and not least when we saw pictures of Humvees being used on the streets of U.S. cities that were still painted in their desert tan, that just been rolled out of Iraq and Afghanistan and put onto the streets of U.S. cities. That image really brought home the lack of authority and the lack of legitimacy of basic institutions in Western states and the US as well. And so it's this research is going to be looking at the how state failure has migrated, I suppose, from the periphery to the core, and how useful it is to be to think with in terms of how our public institutions are responding to the strains and stresses of the current moment.
Mm-hmm. And George?
Yeah, so just actually writing something at the moment back on Gramsci, who's somebody who I haven't, you know, I obviously engaged with previously, but I think there is something today about the politics of culture, and not to talk about culture wars, but to talk about how is it that material politics has been advanced often in the name of culture wars. So I think that it could be a really interesting project, and I'm finding Gramsci, you know, to go back to something that you have read previously, and just realize how, you know, how your position has changed and how and how your kind of engagement with it ends up changing has been really really interesting. So yeah, watch this space for that project to develop. Okay.
All right. And Alex?
Well, I'm continuing my writing about Brazil, which is a never-ending circus, unfortunately, and you know, with Bolsonaro threatening a coup or whatever, so there's plenty in store there. But also, I'm continuing my research, working on a new book project, looking at I guess what I've called social gluing, or what Obama called the epistemological crisis, which is, you know, effectively the growing disbelief in official narratives, and looking at that possibly in terms of Brazilianization, the Brazilianization of the world, which is something that I've written about. So kind of extending that sort of argument.
Right, right. I've seen your Brazilianization of the world pieces, and again, really provocative. Now, finally, the New Books tradition is to end with a book recommendation. So let's start with Alex. Is there a book you can recommend?
I've been dreading this. This is the one question I can't answer. I draw a blank. I like feel like I've never read a book in my life because I can't remember the title of a single thing. But okay, so one which I think influenced me a lot when I was kind of researching as a kind of doing my master's was Boltanski and Chiappello's The New Spirit of Capitalism, which is really about the development of, I guess, neoliberal ideology, of managerialism, of all these ideas of the way that kind of certain countercultural new left ideas around flexibility and so on actually then became used to justify the new form of capitalism that emerged. And I think, and it's quite chunky, but it's the most kind of empirical as well as theoretically informed sort of analysis of this transformation. Something that we've discussed elsewhere on the podcast is the Californian ideology, but I think it's kind of, it's right there in that book.
Okay. George, are you going to recommend the Prison Diaries or Prison Journals?
No, I mean, okay. I mean, Selections from Prison Notebooks by Gramsci is a great collection. I mean, and I agree with Alex. It's difficult. It's like recommend your favorite album, but I if it's okay, I will say one thing that I'm reading at the moment, which is Reconstructing Public Housing by Matthew Thompson, who's a British academic, and I think this is a really interesting history of how you move from this idea of public housing to social housing in the British context, and how these struggles over housing, which we have some echoes today, how they developed, and just and then a classic. So Peter Mayer's Ruling the Void, I think this analysis of the material changes in politics across Western Europe and more widely, and how this led to a void of representation that still determines a lot of politics today. So sorry, that was two. I apologize.
That's okay. And finally, Philip.
Yeah, I for a change, I don't actually have difficulty recommending one. It would be Political Freud, A History by Eli Zaretsky, a cultural historian and historian of psychoanalysis. And it's a book about the different ways in which political Freudianism has unfolded over the course of the 20th century in different cycles. And it's just a remarkable book, astonishing. And in fact, we had an episode of our podcast on it just recently. But I'd recommend the book to all your listeners. It's remarkable.
Okay, thank you. So Alex, George, and Philip, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having us on. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. So we answered sequentially there rather than doing it all at the same time, trying to walk through the door at the same time.
Okay. Well, this has been a conversation with the hosts of Afe Bunga Bunga, the global politics podcast at the end of history. At the end of the end of history. Alex Wachili, George Herrera, and Philip Cunliffe have published The End of the End of History, Politics in the 21st Century, with zero books in 2021. I'm Michael Vann of Sacramento State University, and this has been an episode of New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.